This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Infidel by Ayan Hirsi Ali, narrated by the author and directed by Natanya Johnson. This book is copyrighted 2007 by Ayan Hirsi Ali. This recording is copyrighted 2007 by Recorded Books. Ayan Hirsi Ali was born in Somalia, was raised Muslim, and spent her childhood and young adulthood in Africa and Saudi Arabia. In 1992, Hirsi Ali came to the Netherlands as a refugee, escaping a forced marriage to a distant cousin she had never met. She learned Dutch and worked as an interpreter in abortion clinics and shelters for battered women. After earning her college degree in political science, she worked for the Labour Party. She denounced Islam after the September 11th terrorist attacks, and now fights for the rights of Muslim women in Europe, the enlightenment of Islam, and security in the West. The memoir you are about to hear is the astonishing life story of one of today's most admired and controversial political figures. And now, Infidel.
Introduction. One November morning in 2004, Theo van Gogh got up to go to work at his film production company in Amsterdam. He took out his old black bicycle and headed down a main road. Waiting in a doorway was a Moroccan man with a handgun and two butcher knives. As Theo cycled down the Linnaeusstraat, Mohamed Bouyeri approached. He pulled out his gun and shot Theo several times. Theo fell off his bike and lurched across the road, then collapsed. Bouyeri followed. Theo begged, "Can't we talk about this?" But Bouyeri shot him four more times. Then he took out one of his butcher knives and sawed into Theo's throat. With the other knife, he stabbed a five-page letter onto Theo's chest. The letter was addressed to me. 2 months before, Theo and I had made a short film together. We called it Submission Part 1. I intended one day to make Part 2. Theo warned me that he would work on Part 2 only if I accepted some humor in it. Part 1 was about defiance, about Muslim women who shift from total submission to God to a dialogue with their deity. They pray, but instead of casting down their eyes, these women look up at Allah with the words of the Quran tattooed on their skin. They tell him honestly that if submission to him brings them so much misery, and he remains silent, they may stop submitting. There is the woman who is flogged for committing adultery, another who's given in marriage to a man she loathes, another who's beaten by her husband on a regular basis, and another who's shunned by her father when he learns that his brother raped her. Each abuse is justified by the perpetrators in the name of God, citing the Quran verses now written on the bodies of the women. These women stand for hundreds of thousands of Muslim women around the world. Theo and I knew it was a dangerous film to make. But Theo was a valiant man. He was a warrior, however unlikely that might seem. He was also very Dutch, and no nation in the world is more deeply attached to freedom of expression than the Dutch. The suggestion that he remove his name from the film's credits for security reasons made Theo angry. He told me once, "If I can't put my name on my own film in Holland, then Holland isn't Holland anymore, and I'm not me." People ask me if I have some kind of death wish, to keep saying the things I do. The answer is no. I would like to keep living. However, some things must be said, and there are times when silence becomes an accomplice to injustice. This is the story of my life. It's a subjective record of my own personal memories, as close to accurate as I can make them. My relationship with the rest of my family has been so fractured that I cannot now refresh these recollections by asking them for help. It's the story of what I have experienced, what I have seen, and why I think the way I do. I've come to see that it's useful and maybe even important to tell this story. I want to make a few things clear, set a certain number of records straight, and also tell people about another kind of world and what it's really like. I was born in Somalia. I grew up in Somalia, Saudi Arabia, in Ethiopia and in Kenya. I came to Europe in 1992, when I was 22, and became a Member of Parliament in Holland. I made a movie with Theo, and now I live with bodyguards and armored cars. In April 2006, a Dutch court ordered that I leave my safe home that I was renting from the state. The judge concluded that my neighbors had a right to argue that they felt unsafe because of my presence in the building. I had already decided to move to the United States before the debate surrounding my Dutch citizenship erupted. This book is dedicated to my family and also to the millions and millions of Muslim women who have had to submit. Part 1. My Childhood. Chapter 1. Bloodlines. Who are you? I am Ayan, the daughter of Hirsi, the son of Magan. I am sitting with my grandmother on a grass mat under the talal tree. Behind us is our house, and the branches of the talal tree are all that shields us from the sun blazing down on the white sand. "Go on," my grandmother says, glaring at me. And Magan was the son of Isa. And then Isa was the son of Guled, who was the son of Ali, who was the son of Wa'is, the son of Muhammad, Ali, Umar. I hesitate for a moment. Usman, Mahmud. I catch my breath, proud of myself. "Bah," asks my grandmother, "which concert?" "Bah, Ya'qub, Garab Sare. I name the most powerful of Usman Mahmud's wives, daughter of Ya'qub, she of the highest shoulder." My grandmother nods grudgingly. I have done well for a 5-year-old. I have managed to count my forefathers back for 300 years. The part that is crucially important, Usman Mahmud, is the name of my father's subclan, and thus my own. It's where I belong, who I am. Later, as I grow up, my grandmother will coax and even beat me to learn my father's ancestry 800 years back to the beginning of the great clan of the Darod. I am a Darod, a Harti, a Macherten, an Usman Mahmud. I am of the consort called the Higher Shoulder. I am a Magan. "Get it right," my grandmother warns, shaking a switch at me. "The names will make you strong. They are your bloodline. If you honor them, they'll keep you alive. If you dishonor them, you will be forsaken. You will be nothing. You will lead a wretched life and die alone. Do it again." Somali children must memorize their lineage. This is more important than almost anything. Whenever a Somali meets a stranger, they ask each other, "Who are you?" They trace back their separate ancestries until they find a common forefather. If you share a grandfather, perhaps even an 8th great-grandfather, with a Somali, the two of you are bound together as cousins. You are members of the great family that forms a clan. You offer each other food and hospitality. Although a child belongs to the clan of his father, it may be useful to remember the details of your mother's bloodline too, in case you travel and need a stranger's help. So, though the sweat pearled down our backs on those long afternoons, my big brother Mahat and I learned to chant in unison the names of both our lineages. Later, my grandmother began teaching my little sister Hawea to do the same, but she never got as far with her. Hawea was quick and bright, but she sat still even less often than Mahat and I. The truth is that this ancestral knowledge seemed pointless to us modern children, brought up in concrete houses with hard roofs behind fixed, fenced walls. Mostly we pranced off, dodging the sharp smacks my grandmother aimed at our legs with the switches that she broke off our tree. We would rather climb the tree and play in its branches. Above all, we loved listening to my grandmother's stories while my mother cooked over a charcoal brazier, and we lay on a mat under our tree. These stories never came when we begged for them. They arrived by surprise. My grandmother would be weaving a mat, muttering to herself, and suddenly we would realize that the muttering had turned into a fairy tale. There was once a young nomad who married a beautiful wife, and they had a son, my grandmother would begin. The three of us knew to settle down instantly and pretend to be occupied with something. The slightest interruption could break her mood, and she would growl at us and go back to weaving the thin strips of dried grass that she sewed night and day into a large, elaborate matting. The rains didn't come, so the nomad set out to walk across the desert, looking for pasture where he could settle with his family. Almost as soon as he began walking, he came upon a patch of green young grass. On it was a hut made of strong branches, covered with freshly woven mats and swept clean. The hut was empty. The man went back to his wife and told her that after just one day of walking, he had found the perfect place. But 2 days later, when he returned to the pasture with his wife and baby, they found a stranger standing in the doorway of the hut. This stranger was not tall, but he was thickly built, and he had very white teeth and smooth skin. Hawea would shiver with pleasure, and I with fear. The stranger said, "You have a wife and a child. Take the house. You're welcome to it." And he smiled. The young nomad thought this stranger was remarkably friendly and thanked him. He invited the stranger to visit any time. But the wife felt uncomfortable around the stranger. The baby, too, cried as soon as he cast eyes on this man. That night, an animal sneaked into their hut and stole the baby out of his bed. The man had eaten well and slept heavily. He heard nothing. Such misfortune. The stranger visited the nomad and his wife to tell them of his sorrow. But when he spoke, the wife noticed that there were tiny pieces of red meat between his teeth, and one of those strong, white teeth was just a little bit broken. The man stayed on with the couple in the house. For a whole year, the grass stayed green and the rains came, so there was no reason to move on. The wife had another baby in that hut, another beautiful son, but again, when the child was barely 1 season old, an animal came in the night and grabbed the baby in its jaws. This time, the child's father ran after the creature, but he was too slow to catch up. The third time, the nomad caught up with the creature and struggled with it, but the animal overpowered him. Again, it ate the baby. Finally, after her third baby was eaten, the wife told the nomad she would leave him. So now that stupid nomad had lost everything. "So what have you learned?" my grandmother would shout at us. We knew the answer. That nomad had been lazy. He had taken the first pasture he found, even though there had to be something wrong with it. He had been stupid. He had failed to read the signs, the signals which the baby and the woman had instinctively felt. The stranger was really he who rubs himself with a stick, the monstrous being who transforms himself into a hyena and devours children. We had spotted it. The nomad had been slow of mind, slow of limb, weak in strength and valor. He deserved to lose everything. My grandmother's stories could be chilling. There were stories about an ugly old witch whose name was People Slayer or People Butcher, who had the power to transform herself, to adopt the face of someone you liked and respected, and who at the last minute lunged at you, laughing in your face, ha 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 ha, before she slaughtered you with a long sharp knife that she had been hiding under the folds of her robe all along and then ate you up. My grandmother told us tales from when she was young of the bands of fighters who raided the desert, stealing animals and women, burning settlements. She told us about all the unrecorded disasters of her life and her parents' lives, the pandemics of plague and malaria, and drought that left whole regions barren of life. She told us also about her life, the good times when the rains came and made everything green, when streams of water suddenly raced through the dried riverbeds and there was milk and meat in abundance. She tried to teach us how that led to decadence, how when the grass grows green, herders become lazy and children grow fat, how men and women mix in singing and drumming at twilight, and how that erodes their watchfulness so that they fail to spot danger. Such mingling, she warned us, leads to competition, conflict, disaster. Sometimes in my grandmother's stories, there were brave women, mothers like my mother, who used their cunning and their courage to save their children from danger. This made us feel safe, in a way. My grandmother and my mother, too, were brave and clever. They would surely be able to save us when our time came to face the monsters. In Somalia, little children learn quickly to be alert to betrayal. Things are not always what they seem. Even a small slip can be fatal. The moral of every one of my grandmother's stories rested on our honor. We must be strong, clever, suspicious. We must obey the rules of the clan. Suspicion is good, especially if you're a girl. For girls can be taken, or they may yield. And if a girl's virginity is despoiled, she not only obliterates her own honor, she also damages the honor of her father, uncles, brothers, male cousins. There is nothing worse than to be the agent of such catastrophe. Even though we loved her stories, mostly we ignored my grandmother. She herded us around, much as she did the goats that she would tether to our tree, but we were more unruly. Stories and squabbles were our pastimes. I don't think I ever saw a toy till I was 8 and we had moved to Saudi Arabia. We pestered each other. Hawea and Mahat ganged up on me, or Hawea and I ganged up on Mahat. But my brother and I never did anything as a team. We hated each other. My grandmother always said this was because I was born just 1 year after Mahat. I stole Ma's lap from him. We had no father because our father was in prison. I had no memory of him at all. Most of the adults I knew grew up in the deserts of Somalia. The easternmost country in Africa and one of the poorest, Somalia juts into the Indian Ocean, cradling the tip of the Arabian Peninsula like a protective hand before dropping down the coast to Kenya. My family were nomads who moved constantly through the northern and northeastern deserts to find pasture for their herds. They would settle sometimes for a season or two. When there was no longer enough water and pasture, or if the rains failed, they picked up their hut and stacked their mats onto camels and walked, trying to find somewhere better to keep their herds alive. My grandmother learned to weave dry grass so tight you could carry water for miles in one of her pitchers. She could make her own small domed house out of bent boughs and woven mats, then dismantle it and load it onto a nasty-tempered transport camel. When my grandmother was about 10 years old, her father, an Isaac herder, died. Her mother married her uncle. This is a common practice. It saves her dowry and trouble. When my grandmother was about 13, that uncle received a proposal for my grandmother's hand from a wealthy nomad named Artan, who was about 40 years old. Artan was Dolbahante, which was a good bloodline of the Darod. He was widely respected, skilled with animals, and a good navigator. He could read his environment so well that he always knew when to move and where to go to find rain. Other clan members came to him to arbitrate their disputes. Artan was already married, but he and his wife had only one child, a daughter who was a little younger than my grandmother. When he decided to take another wife, Artan first chose the father of the bride. He must be a man from a good clan with a decent reputation. The girl must be hardworking, strong, young and pure. My grandmother, Ibadu, was all that. Artan paid a bride price for her. A few days after Artan married her and took her away, my grandmother bolted. She managed to walk almost all the way back to her mother's camp before Artan caught up with her. He agreed to let her rest for a bit with her mother to recover. Then, after a week, her stepfather took her to Artan's camp and told her, "This is your destiny." For the rest of her life, my grandmother was irreproachable in every way. She raised 8 girls and 1 boy, and never was there a whisper of gossip about their virtue or their work. She instilled willpower and obedience and a sense of honor in her children. She grazed animals, fetched firewood, built fences of sticks laced with thorn branches. She had hard hands and a hard head, and when her husband hosted clan meetings in his role as a clan arbiter, she kept her girls safely apart from the men and the singing and the drums. They could listen only from afar to the poetry competitions and watch as the men traded goods and tales. My grandmother showed no jealousy toward her older co-wife, though she stayed out of her way. When the older co-wife died, my grandmother tolerated the presence of her haughty stepdaughter, Khadija, the girl who was almost her own age. Artan had 9 daughters and a young wife. Guarding the honor of his women was of paramount importance. He kept them well away from any other nomads, roaming for weeks to find a place with pasture and no young men. They navigated endlessly through the remotest deserts. As we sat under the talal tree outside our house in Mogadishu, my grandmother often told us about the beautiful emptiness of sitting in front of a hut she had built with her own hands, staring into the vast, never-ending space. In a sense, my grandmother was living in the Iron Age. There was no system of writing among the nomads. Metal artifacts were rare and precious. The British and Italians claimed to be ruling Somalia, but this would have meant nothing to my grandmother. To her, there were only the clans. The great nomad clans of the Issaq and the Darod, the lesser Hawiya farmers, and lower still, the inferior Sab. The first time she saw a white person, my grandmother was in her 30s. She thought this person's skin had burned off. My mother, Asha, was born sometime in the early 1940s, along with her identical twin sister, Halima. My grandmother gave birth to them alone under a tree. They were her 3rd and 4th children. She was about 18, leading her goats and sheep to pasture when she felt the pains. She lay down and bore forth. Then she cut the umbilical cords with her knife. A few hours later, she gathered together the goats and sheep and managed to bring the herd safely home before dark, carrying her newborn twins. Nobody was impressed by the exploit. She was only bringing home 2 more girls. To my grandmother, feelings were a foolish self-indulgence. Pride was important, though. Pride in your work and your strength and self-reliance. If you are weak, people would speak ill of you. If your thorn fences were not strong enough, your animals would be raided by lions, hyenas and foxes, your husband would marry another, your daughter's virginity would be stolen, and your sons seen as worthless. In her eyes, we were useless children. Bred in a cement block house with a hard roof, we had no skills of value. We walked on roadways. The road in front of our house wasn't paved, but still it was a marked passage in the dirt. We had water from a tap. We could never have found our way home after herding animals through the desert. We couldn't even milk a goat without getting kicked over. My grandmother reserved particular scorn for me. I was terrified of insects, so in her eyes, I was a truly stupid child. By the time her daughters were 5 or 6, my grandmother had already taught them every major skill they would need to survive. I lacked all of them. My mother told us stories too. She had learned to care for her father's animals and herded them through the desert to places that were safe. The goats were easy prey for a predator. So was a young girl. if my mother or her sisters were attacked by men out in the desert, it would be their own fault. They should have fled at the first sight of an unknown camel. If they were ever captured, they were to say three times, Allah be my witness, I want no conflict with you, please leave me alone. To be raped would be far worse than dying, because it would tarnish the honor of everyone in their family. If the invocation to Allah had no effect, my grandmother taught her daughters to run around behind a man, squat down, reach between his legs under his sarong, and yank his testicles hard. They were not to let go. He might hit or kick, but they were to tuck in their heads and take the blows on their backs and hope to hang on long enough to cause the attacker to faint. This move is called qorgoys, and the women of my grandmother's family taught it to their daughters just as they taught them to make thorn bush fences to protect the hut from hyenas. I remember one afternoon when Hawa and I were small children, watching my grandmother rubbing sheep fat into a long coil of woven rope before she steeped it in the plant dye that would make it hard and black. A woman alone is like a piece of sheep fat in the sun, she told us. Everything will come and feed on that fat. Before you know it, the ants and insects are crawling all over it until there's nothing left but a smear of grease. My grandmother pointed to a gobbet of fat melting in the sun just beyond the talal tree's shadow. It was black with ants and gnats. For years, this image inhabited my nightmares. When my mother was a child, she was always dutiful, always obedient. But as she grew up, the world began changing. The old traditions of the nomads were shifting as modern life lured them to villages and cities. So, when she was about 15 years old, my mother walked out of the desert. She left her parents and her older sisters and even her twin sister behind her and began walking. Then she got on a truck and went to the port city of Berbera, and she took a ship across the Red Sea to Arabia. Khadija had preceded her. Khadija was her older stepsister, the child of her father's first wife. Another of my mother's older sisters made the trip too. I don't know what led them to do it. My mother rarely confided her private emotions. But it was the 1950s, and modern life was jabbing its sharp elbow into the farthest parts of the world. My mother was young after all, and I think perhaps she simply didn't want to be left behind in the desert when all the young people had left for the city. My mother went to Aden, where Khadija had already settled, a big city, a center of Britain's colonial rule over the Middle East. She got a job cleaning house for a British woman. She learned about forks and chairs and bathtubs and cleaning brushes. She loved the strict rituals, cleaning, folding, ironing, and the elaborate paraphernalia of settled life. My mother became even more scrupulously attentive about such matters than the woman she worked for. Although she was alone in Aden, without parental supervision, my mother was supremely virtuous. She was determined that nobody would ever have grounds to gossip that she, Aisha Artan, had behaved improperly. She never took a taxi or a bus for fear of being seated beside a strange man. She shunned the Somali men who chewed qat and the girls who brewed tea for them and joked around as the buzzy euphoria of the short, fat little leaves got them talking and laughing. Instead, in Aden, my mother learned to pray in the proper Islamic manner. Living in the desert, my grandmother had never really had the time to pray. Among the nomads, women weren't expected to. It was men who spread their prayer mats on the sand five times a day and faced Mecca, chanting the Quran. But now, on the Arabian Peninsula, where the Prophet Muhammad received Allah's revelation, my mother learned the ritual ablutions. She learned to cover herself with a plain cloth and pray standing, sitting, prostrating, turning right and left, the ballet of submission to Allah. In the desert, nomad women were not covered. They worked, and it's hard to work under a long veil. While my grandmother herded and cooked, she draped herself in a roughly woven long cloth, the go, leaving her arms, hair, and neck bare. In my grandmother's day, men were commonly present while women breastfed their children. If there was anything arousing about seeing a few inches of female flesh, the men never showed it. My mother had no protector in Aden, no father, no brother. Men leered and bothered her on the street. She began wearing a veil like the Arab women who robed when they left their houses in a long black cloth that left only a slit for their eyes. The veil protected her from those leering men and from the feeling of vileness it gave her to be looked at that way. Her veil was an emblem of her belief. To be beloved of God, you had to be modest. And Aisha Artan wanted to be the most proper, most virtuous woman in the city. One day, my grandfather Artan came to Aden. He told my mother that he had received a request for her hand in marriage and had accepted. My mother was about 18. She could not defy her father. So she stayed silent. A virgin's silence is the proper answer to a marriage proposal. It signifies a dignified consent. So my mother married this man, whose name was Ahmed, although she disliked him on sight. He was too short and too dark, and he smoked, which to her was as bad as chewing qat. Ahmed was a darod, as she was, and of the hearty too, like her. But instead of being a nomad Lulba hunter like my mother, he was a trader, a Wersengeli. My mother therefore looked down on this man, although he was wealthy. This Wersengeli man moved my mother to Kuwait, where she was mistress of a big house with a tile floor, hot running water, and electricity. The first thing my mother did was fire all the maids. Nobody could clean the house well enough for Aisha Artan. She set about creating an exemplary household. She had a son and called him Muhammad, after the Prophet, the proper name for an oldest boy. Then her father, who was an old man now, died, and my mother did something extremely surprising. She told her husband that she wanted a divorce. Of course, my mother had no right to a divorce under Muslim law. The only way she could have claimed one was if her husband had been impotent or left her completely indigent. All the members of her clan in Kuwait told her she was being ridiculous. Her husband was wealthy, and although he could have afforded several wives, he came home to her every night. What more could she want? If she divorced, my mother would be used goods, no longer a virgin, and besides, they argued, she'd get a reputation that she was not Bari. A woman who is Bari is like a pious slave. She honors her husband's family and feeds them without question or complaint. She never whines or makes demands of any kind. She is strong in service, but her head is bowed. If her husband is cruel, if he rapes her and then taunts her about it, if he decides to take another wife or beats her, she lowers her gaze and hides her tears, and she works hard, faultlessly. She's a devoted, welcoming, well-trained work animal. This is Bari. If you are a Somali woman, you must learn to tell yourself that God is just and all-knowing and will reward you in the hereafter. Meanwhile, everyone who knows about your patience and endurance will applaud your father and mother on the excellence of your upbringing. Your brothers will be grateful to you for preserving their honor. They will boast to other families about your heroic submission. And perhaps, eventually, your husband's family will appreciate your obedience, and your husband may one day treat you as a fellow human being. If, in the process of being Bari, you feel grief, humiliation, fatigue, or a sense of everlasting exploitation, you hide it. If you long for love and comfort, you pray in silence to Allah to make your husband more bearable. Prayer is your strength. Nomadic mothers must try to give their daughters this skill and strength called Bari. For years, my ma had been perfect. Her virtue had been legendary. Her work habits impeccable. Partly it was her nature. My mother found strength and comfort in clear-cut rules and the dead certainty that if she were good, she would go to paradise. I think, though, that she also feared her father might curse her if she disobeyed. A father's curse is the worst thing that can happen to you, a ticket straight to hell. But after her father died, my mother defied her husband. She turned away from him with the full force of the scorn she had stored up for so long. She refused even to speak to him. Finally, he agreed not to contest her claim for a divorce. A Kuwaiti judge granted her 7 more years with her son. When he was 10, Muhammad would return to live with his father. Till then, my mother was permitted to bring up her son alone. When my mother was growing up, Somalia didn't exist. Although all the clans spoke the same language, albeit different dialects, they mostly lived in separate territories and saw themselves as distinct. The territory that is now Somalia was divided between the British and the Italians, who occupied the country as colonizers, splitting it in two. In 1960, the colonists left, leaving behind them a brand new independent state. A unified nation was born. This new country, Somalia, had a democracy, a president, a flag, an army, even its own currency. Sepia banknotes with dignified portraits of farm animals and people working in fields, like no scene my mother had ever witnessed. People who had always lived deep in rural areas began streaming to the country's new capital, which the colonizers called Mogadishu. They thrilled to the idea of building one nation, great and powerful. So many hopes would be dashed in the coming years by the clan infighting, the corruption and violence into which the country, like so much of Africa, fell. But my mother couldn't have guessed what would happen. So, like so many others, she packed her bags, took her son and the dowry her husband had given her when she married him, and returned to Somalia, to Mogadishu, the capital, where she had never been. For the rest of her life, my grandmother berated my mother for this decision. Mogadishu was not Darod land. It was not even Isaac. It was deep in Hawiya territory, where my mother didn't belong. My grandmother always said that my mother's ex-husband must have cursed her, causing this foolhardy choice. Or maybe a jinn was let loose by my mother's bare-faced defiance of the marriage made for her by her father. My grandmother hated the hard cement houses, the narrow streets, the lack of a horizon in Mogadishu. And she hated knowing that her family was no longer safe in the Darod lands in the north. But once again, my mother departed from the traditions of her parents. And once again, she was following her sister, Khadija Artan, who had settled in Mogadishu with her husband. Khadija was a striking woman, as tall as my mother and just as lean. She had taut, angular features, hawk-like eyes, and a domineering manner. Her voice was powerful and her gestures dignified and elaborate. My grandmother loathed her. Khadija was bald. She wore long Western dresses that went down to her ankles, but were held slim against her body with zips and buttons. She also draped cloth of the rural gore and the urban dir'a around her. But Khadija's gores and dir'as were made of the choicest fabrics, expensive silks and chiffon instead of the basic cottons, and the way she wore them made other women seem clumsy and inadequate. Khadija held her hair high in a turban of cloth. She was modern. She was ecstatic about independence, the politics, and nightly discussions on the street. She positively bustled with self-importance through the new capital city. Although she was married and well married too, Khadija was barren. A terrible destiny. Some people said it was because she was a witch and strong-willed. My grandmother muttered that it was a curse for disobedience and waywardness. If there was a curse, Khadija managed to ignore it. Khadija counseled my mother to buy a plot of land opposite a trucking business owned by her husband's oldest son by a previous wife. It was a new neighborhood, and now that Mogadishu had become the capital, Darod had begun moving in there. This area, Ohodhon, was cleaner and healthier than the center of town, where the graceful old Italian buildings were surrounded by filthy, densely packed streets. The roads were unpaved in our neighborhood, and not many houses had electricity. Our house never did. But Ma bought the land. She moved into Khadija's place and began planning to build her own house. My mother's idea of a house emerged in fits and starts as materials became available. There were just two big rooms with whitewashed cinder block walls and a cement floor. The area in front of the main door was also cement. The rest was sand. Building this house took a long time. Everything was painted white, except the doors and shutters, which were green, the color my mother felt was appropriate for a proper Muslim door. The cooking fire was outside, under an awning, beside a tall talal tree, where a man might spread his mat in the shade on a hot afternoon. Khadija was a busybody, always directing other people's destinies and arranging marriages. My mother was young, and she didn't have much to do. It would not have been proper for her to work. Khadija suggested that she leave little Muhammad with her and go out, perhaps attend a literacy class. A young man called Hirsi Magan had just returned from a university in America, and he was teaching ordinary people in Mogadishu to read and write. That young man, Hirsi Magan, would become my father. When I was little, he was like a hero in a fable to me, only a little more real than my grandmother's werewolves. My father's older sister, Aunt Hawa Magan, used to come to our house and tell us stories about him, how he grew up in the northern desert. Their father, Magan, had been a legendary warrior. His name meant the protector, or more specifically, the protector of those he conquered. Magan was an Isman Mahmud, from the Darod sub-clan that always claimed the right to conquer and rule over other peoples. Magan had fought for King Boqor, who ruled the Macherten lands near the sea. And then around 1890, he switched allegiance to Boqor's rival, Kenadid, who was a younger man and more eager to wage war and lead raids. Boqor, Magan and Kenadid were all cousins. Kenadid and Magan led their warriors through the southern lands of Sanag and Muduk, which were occupied by smaller clans, including many Hawiya. The Hawiya were passive people, mostly farmers, and they had no army. Magan despised them. There is a story that he had once Hawiya villagers gather stones into a circle and then handed them inside it to be killed. Then he commanded his warriors to take the women and settle there, on Hawiya land, north of Mogadishu. According to my grandmother, the Hawiya in the Muduk region never forgot the name of Magan. My father grew up in the northern desert, the son of Magan's last and youngest wife. She was 12 or 13 when she married the older warrior, who was close to 70. My father was Magan's youngest son, and the old man doted on him. When Magan died, my father was raised by his older brothers, some so old they already had grandchildren. They took him riding across the desert almost before he could walk. Magan's sons were rich and powerful traders and warriors. My father grew up well cared for, bright, self-assured, pampered. He became friends with an older man, Isman Yusuf Kenadid, the grandson of the Kenadid whom his father had served. Magan had always mocked this man. He was quiet and covered his mouth with a cloth, because words are not something you should waste. They should come out of deep, prior reflection. Eloquence, the use of fine language, is admired in Somalia. The work of great poets is praised and memorized for miles around their villages, sometimes for generations. But few poets or people had ever written down any Somali words. The schools the colonizers had left behind were simply too few to educate a nation that now consisted of millions of people. Isman Yusuf Kenadid was learned. He had invented a script to write down the sounds of the Somali language for the first time. People called it Ismaniye. It was slanted and curly and ingenious, and my father set about learning it. Isman was a good tutor, and he had many connections with the Italian colonists who ruled southern Somalia. My father, his protégé, began attending a school in Mogadishu, the Italian's colonial capital. He joined the Somali Youth League and had heated discussions about the future when the colonial powers who ruled over the great Somali nation could be cast off and one country formed to dazzle Africa. He learned Italian and even went to study in Rome for a period. This was a rare opportunity for a Somali, but Magan's descendants were wealthy. He married a woman, Marian Farah, from the Marehan subclan of the Darod. Then my father decided to attend college in the United States, Columbia University in New York. He was inspired by America. He used to say, "If they can achieve what they have after only 200 years, then we Somalis, with our endurance and our resilience, we can make America in Africa." My father insisted that his wife Marian join him, and she began studying there too. Their infant daughter, Arro, born in 1965, was left behind in Somalia with her grandmother. When he graduated from Columbia with a degree in anthropology, he returned to Somalia, like many other privileged young men, to help shape the future of their nation. Marian had failed her course. He required that she stay in America until she completed it. It seemed only natural to him to proceed to the new nation's capital, Mogadishu. My father thought that if a bold new nation were to be established, then the people must be literate. He started a campaign to teach people to read and write. To set an example, he himself went to teach in one of the classes. In Somalia, language is precious. It's all that binds the warring clans into what passes for a single nation. People flocked to Hirsi Magan's literacy class in Mogadishu. He was dark-skinned, long-nosed, with a high forehead. My father had the charm of a rather intellectual crooner. Though he was not tall, he had a presence. People loved to be around him. All his life, they listened to him with respect. My mother was a graceful, clever poet in her own right and became one of his best students. She learned quickly. One day, she even dared to contest the way her teacher pronounced a Somali word, flicking back her shawl with haughty disdain. It was daring of her and surprising. She was beautiful too, slim and tall, with a back as straight as a young tree. My father was attracted to my mother's clever tongue and her inflexible opinions. The attraction was mutual, and of course, Khadija encouraged them. My parents married in 1966. My mother knew that my father was still married to his first wife, Marian. But Marian was in New York, and my father did not inform her of his new bride. Marian learned of it when she returned to Somalia, of course. I don't know precisely when that was. There was always a strong electricity between my father and mother. They teased each other, challenged each other. In a culture that disapproved of choosing your own partner, they chose each other. Their bond was strong. In October 1968, my brother Mahat was born. My parents finished building the house on the land my mother had bought in Mogadishu and moved in, bringing with them my older stepbrother, Muhammad, who was 6. My mother quickly became pregnant again, with me, and my grandmother came to Mogadishu from the desert to help her through the last few months of pregnancy. My father was bold, learned, popular, born to rule. He ran for parliament from the northern town of Qardo, but lost the election. He spent vast amounts of his own money funding literacy campaigns and invested in a sugar factory. He was involved in a project to build a dam in the north so people could have water all year round, instead of watching the river drain away into cracks in the sand. On October 21, 1969, the government was overthrown in a coup. 23 days later, I was born on November 13, 6 weeks too early and weighing a little more than 3 pounds. Perhaps my parents were happy. My father must have dandled me on his knee from time to time. I don't remember. Mahat says he can remember our father from those days, but they are only glancing recollections. Father was so often out of the house. My sister Hawea was born in May 1971. A few months after that, my father's first wife, Marian Farah, gave birth to my stepsister Ichabo. There was some sort of dispute, and my father and Marian divorced. And then, in April 1972, when I was 2 years old, my father was taken away. He was put in the worst place in Mogadishu, the old Italian prison they called the Hall. Chapter 2. Under the Talal Tree. I used to try to imagine my father when I was little. My mother, when I asked her, only told me that we had never met. Afwene, who was a real monster, not like the kind in grandmother stories, had put my father in jail. Afwene, Big Mouth, was what everyone called the president, Siad Barre. There were huge portraits of him in every shop and every public space in Mogadishu. He had a huge mouth with big, long teeth. Sometimes, Afwene's special police burst into houses and took people away. They tortured them into admitting something terrible, and then they killed them. Even I knew that. The adults in my house all went suddenly still when we had the executioner's rifle in Tribunka Square. Siad Barre had become the vice commander of Somalia's army at the time of independence in 1960, and later became an advocate of Marxism after training with Soviet officers. He was a Marehan, a small subclan of the Darod, and of very humble background. The exact circumstances of the coup are not very well known. It's not clear whether Barre ordered the assassination of the president or whether he simply took power in the aftermath of the president's assassination. His regime was a classic Soviet client state, with a single party, single trade union, a women's organization, and young pioneer groups. A great deal of money was spent on weaponry rather than on development. But still, there was a conscious investment in schools, whether to educate children to adore the regime or simply to educate them. Every night, till I was six, as my mother stood over the charcoal brazier, we children knelt in a semicircle and begged Allah to free our father. At the time, this didn't make an enormous amount of sense. My mother never took the time to really tell us about God. He just was, and he minded the prayers of little children most of all. But although I tried my best to pray hard, it didn't seem to be working. When I asked Ma why Allah hadn't set my father free yet, she just urged us to pray more. Our mother could visit our father in prison, but only my brother Mahat was allowed to go with her. Hawea and I had to stay at home with Grandma. We were too little to go out with my mother, and we were girls. Mahat, in every way, came first. Our brother was always angry when he came back from these visits, and my mother made him promise not to tell us anything about them. We might stupidly let some information out, and the secret police might hear. Once, as he was walking out of the jail with my mother, Mahat attacked the huge cardboard portrait of Afwene hung at the entrance. He must have been about six. He was throwing stones at it and yelling. Ma told my grandmother when she came home that night, "Thank Allah the prison guard was from our clan." Ma sounded as if she couldn't help admiring Mahat's warrior spirit. But the guard could have accused her of teaching her son to oppose the government, to be an anti. I knew that were it not for Allah and the protection of the clan, Hawea and I could have been sitting alone under the tree that night with my grandmother, begging Allah to free our mother and brother from prison too. Allah was a mystery to me. One of my first memories, from when I was perhaps 3 years old, is of watching my grandmother engaged in an inexplicable performance. She was crouching face down on a mat in her bedroom with her nose on the floor. I thought that she was playing some kind of game with me, so I pranced around and made faces at her, poking. She ignored me and continued bending up and down, muttering things that sounded maddeningly strange. I couldn't understand it. Finally, when she had finished, she turned around to me with a very scary look on her face. "Bastard child," she cursed, hitting me and biting my arms. "Let Almighty Allah take you away. May you never even smell paradise." My cousin Sanyar, the 13-year-old daughter of my mother's twin, extricated me from my grandmother's fierce grasp and took me outside. Sanyar helped my grandmother look after us when Ma was out. She was kind and explained that I had disturbed my grandmother in prayer, which was like talking to God, the most important moment of an adult's life. I was startled. I knew for sure there had been nobody but Grandma and me in that room. Sanyar said I was too little to understand. When I grew up, I would feel Allah's presence. My grandmother's vision of the universe was complex. A whole cosmology of magical entities existed alongside the one God, Allah. Jinns, who could be male or female, lived in an intermediate sphere adjoining ours and could be counted on to bring misfortune and disease. The souls of wise men and dead ancestors could also intercede with God on your behalf. Another afternoon, when we were a little older, Hawea and I were fooling around under the talal tree when we heard Grandma talking. She had taken to her bed, suffering from some bout of pain, and we knew better than to disturb her. We crept over to the door of the room to listen. "Dear forefathers, let me go," Grandmother said in a choking voice. There was no reply. Then came a thump. "Habokor, let me go," thump. "Hassan, let me go," thump. "Dear forefathers, let me go," thump. Hawea and I were consumed with curiosity. We wanted to see these people. We opened the door slowly. Grandma was lying on her back, dressed in beautiful glittering clothes, as if it were the Eid festival. The room was full of the scent of smoldering frankincense, and she was hitting her chest with her hands, following each blow with a choked pleading. "Dear forefathers, let me go," she gasped, as if she were being strangled. Puzzled, we looked about. There was no one in the room, nothing that remotely resembled a forefather, not that we had ever seen one. I pushed Hawea back and shut the door as silently as I could, but we were mystified. A few days later, we began to act out the scene. We lay next to one another in bed and begged our imagined forefathers to let us go in choking voices. Grandma burst into the room, followed by Ma. "May you burn in hell," Grandma screeched at us. "May the devil snatch you." She chased us around the room and threatened to pack her bags and leave. Ma had to punish us. She needed Grandma. My mother was always out of the house, and this too was because of Afwene. Siad Barre introduced a police state in Somalia and also tried to set up a pretend economy. He allied with the Soviet Union, so Somalia had to become a communist country. In practice, for ordinary families, this meant that they had to wait in a series of long lines for hours under the merciless rays of the Mogadishu sun to receive limited amounts of basic food, flour, sugar, oil, sorghum, rice, and beans. There was no meat, no eggs or fruit, no vegetables, and no olive oil or butter. Any extras had to be smuggled on the black market. Ma never told us when she was leaving on a trip. She was there, and suddenly she was gone, sometimes for weeks at a time. I discovered that there was a kind of pattern to her movements. My distant but somehow dependable mother would become miserable. "What should I do now? Oh Allah," she would wail. "Alone with three children and an old woman. Do I deserve to be punished like this?" My ma would cry, and my grandma would speak to her comfortingly. I would climb onto her lap and pat her, which only made her cry more. Then she would disappear for a while to some far-off village, often traveling with one of her father's cousins, a trader who had long ago sold his camels, bought a truck, and now transported food to the city. Sometimes I would see her coming home on the back of her truck just after sunset. Men dragged in sacks of food, rice, flour, sugar, and aluminium jars filled with tiny pieces of camel meat soaked in lard with dates and garlic. These unloadings were quick and secretive and were practically the only times we came into contact with men at all. We were told to say nothing about the food, which was stored under the beds. Otherwise, our mother and her cousin too could go to jail. One time, soldiers from the feared Gulwadhe Brigade came to the house. Ma was out. They were Afwane's special guards, worse even than the police. A young man in a green uniform with a gun walked into our compound. Grandma was sitting under the talal tree. Startled and angry, she stood up. She was only a little taller than I was, but imperious. "You of lower birth," she began declaiming. "Your gun won't give you back your missing honor." Grandma hated the government. "You are only good for bullying old women and children whose father your craven master has imprisoned." I ran inside the house, frightened. I could see there were at least three other uniformed men standing near our fence. The soldier made a move toward the house, and Grandma tried to block him off. She was much shorter than he was, but she had a fierce look about her. She stuck her neck out at him and jabbed with the long, sharp needle she used for weaving mats and baskets held tightly in her fist. The soldier commanded her to get out of his way. "Coward!" Grandma jeered at him. Then he pushed her. She fell back and then ran at him with her needle. "Coward! Coward!" she hissed. For a moment, he hesitated. He looked at his colleagues in the distance. I thought he might go. Then he pushed Grandma with force. She fell on the ground, on her back. He and the others came in and turned everything upside down. Then they left. Grandma shouted after them, "Sons of prostitutes, Allah will burn you in hell." She looked exhausted, and the look on her face scared me enough to save my questions for some other time. Much later that evening, Ma returned from her visit to my father in jail. She went there often. She cooked special food for him, choosing the most delicate parts of the animal, cutting the meat into tiny pieces, the size of a thumbnail, marinating them and stewing them for days. My baby sister Qumman was born when I was 3, but the only thing I remember about her is her death. There is a picture in my mind of a tall man standing in the doorway, holding a bundled infant in his arms. Everyone was whispering, "Inna lillahi wa inna ilahi raji'un." From Allah we come and to Allah we return. I remember pulling Ma's shawl and telling her that this man was trying to take away my sister. I remember my mother just chanting the same words over and over again along with everyone else. Then in my memory, the man leaves with Qumman, who's screaming, and Ma follows him, her face blank with pain. Years later, when I became old enough to understand what death was, I asked my mother why baby Qumman had been screaming if she was dead. My mother said I had been the one doing the screaming. It had gone on for hours, as if I couldn't stop. There were so many funerals in my childhood. Aunt Khadija's husband, our uncle Eid, died when I was 4. Never again would he drive up in his black car and bounce us on his lap, joking. Then Aunt Hawa Magan, my father's sister, became ill. She was very affectionate, and if we chanted our lineage correctly, she gave us candy and boiled eggs. Hawa and I were allowed to go with my mother to the hospital. When she died, I wailed inconsolably. "She's gone. There's nothing to be done about it," my mother told me. "Stop crying. It's the way things are. Being born means we have to die someday. There is a paradise, and good people like Aunt Hao find peace there." My mother's oldest sister, who was also named Hao, came to stay with us when she fell ill. She had something inside her breast that meant she had to lie down on a mat on the floor all day. I'll never forget the endless, muffled groans of pain coming through Aunt Hao's gritted teeth as she lay there day in, day out. Grandma, Ma, and Ma's twin sister Aunt Halimo took turns smearing malmal herbs on her chest. When this Aunt Hawa died, there was a great gathering of women at our house. They built several fires, and lots of women cooked and talked. Some of the women swayed and waved their arms over their heads and screamed in cadence.
Allah ba'aye, Allah hogaye, Allah chabayo da'aye, nafta, nafta, nafta. Oh God, I am eliminated. Oh God, I am devastated. Oh God, I am broken and fallen. The soul, the soul, the soul.
When they reached the third line, the women fell to their knees in theatrical hysterics. Then they got up and clutched their throats and cried out in shrill tones, Nafta, Nafta, Nafta. The soul, the soul, the soul. My mother was appalled. I could see that. Such disrespect for the dead, she hissed. Isaac women, they have no sense of honor or manners. How can they abandon themselves so shamelessly? Ma was mourning quietly in a corner, as is proper among her own Dulbahante, a subclan of the Darod. She was so engrossed in her grief for Hao and her mounting anger at the Isaac women that she hardly noticed that Hawea and I were watching the whole scene.